Thank you. I invite you to turn to the back of your bulletin where you'll find the scripture reading for today. And we want to focus, as we have been, on going through the book of James as we come to the end of the first chapter with a parable about a mirror. Now, over the years, my hygiene has changed for the better. I'm not talking about the apocryphal stories of when in my 20s my wife will tell you that I went for 7 days once without showering, which actually is not apocryphal, it's true. I did it while contemplating a theological problem, and I realized you don't want to do that because there's so many problems, you'll never shower. So I did do that, but it was before I was married, it was when I was home alone, it was on vacation, so I didn't see people for 7 days, I was just stuck in my room. But as a younger man in my teens, in early 20s, I spent hours in front of the mirror, preening over the glory of my hair. I had long hair. I still hope that in glory, whatever the transformed life is, the glorified resurrection body is, I hope it involves long hair. And if it does, I'll have the longest mane of anyone. So if you're looking for me in glory, you'll spot me because I'll have hair down to my ankles. But I'd spent hours doing my hair, hour and a half, 2 hours. It was not unusual for me to do that. And now it takes me 5 minutes at most. I mean, I'm in and out of the shower and ready to go. I also had very, very bad acne as a teenager and into my 20s and 30s. I still have it. My mother's Mexican. I have very oily skin. And so I would sometimes, as a young person, be very self-conscious of that and would spend hours and hours cleaning and popping and covering and all the things you do in order to try to deal with that challenge. I spent a lot of time in front of a mirror, but of course that's what a mirror is for. You look into a mirror in order to discover what you need to change. So many of you got up this morning, and as you were dressing, you might have straightened your tie in the mirror or retouched your lipstick or fixed your hair, plucked a rogue nose hair or eyebrow. We all do those things. But if you look into the mirror and see the problem and do nothing, then what good is a mirror? And of course, that's James' point in his parable. He wants us to hear the word. He wants us to look into the mirror, which is his way of describing God's word. But he challenges us that if we look in the mirror and do nothing, then the mirror actually has no value, no matter how long we've looked into it. The mirror. Mirrors always tell the truth. That's the challenge with a mirror, and that's what's interesting about describing the word or the gospel as a mirror. It shows us things we don't like to see. We can't hide our wrinkles. We can't hide our pockmarks. If you get up in the morning like I do, you don't have the most pleasant face. You got glazed over eyes, your hair sticking out in wrong places, and facing that mirror in the morning isn't that pleasant. Because it doesn't gloss over any defects. It shows us every wart and gray hair and every pimple. But that's why we have a mirror. We get up in the morning and we go through this unpleasant experience of looking at ourselves in the mirror precisely because we know that if we don't do that, we're going to show this morning face to the world. We're going to reveal something about ourselves that is unsightly. And so we take care, we shave, we brush our teeth, we make adjustments so that the world won't see our morning face, but we're actually presentable to the world. That's what James is trying to get at when he speaks of the word as a mirror. He wants us not only to look in the mirror, but to act upon what we see. So in verse 22, he invites us, be doers of the word and not merely hearers who deceive themselves. For if any are hearers of the word and not doers, here's what they're like. And now he tells his parable. They are like those who look at themselves in a mirror, and they look at themselves, and on going away, they immediately forget what they look like. Out of sight, out of mind. You might have that rogue hair. You might have that uncombed tassel on the top of your head, but you don't do anything about it, and you move on forgetting what you'd actually seen in the morning. This man sees, but he doesn't respond, and looking into the mirror made absolutely no difference in his life. What James would like us to do is not just be mere hearers looking into the mirror, but acting on what we see. So he says in verse 25 something very important. But those who look into the perfect law, the law of liberty. Now you get to see what that mirror is. It's the perfect law, the law of liberty. And persevere, being not hearers who forget, but doers who act, they'll be blessed in their doing. So he invites us to look intently in the mirror, and as we look intently, to do something about it. And if we do something about it, we'll be blessed in our doing. And in this, he is just speaking as his brother did, as Jesus did. Jesus is the one who said, if you know these things, you are blessed if you do them. There is no blessing in just hearing and not doing. But what I find particularly interesting about verse 25 is the kind of language James has shifted into. He's been speaking about those who've been born by the Word, and he's just spoken of the Word. But now he describes the Word in a very Jewish manner, because he's a Jewish man, a Jewish Christian. And he says in verse 25, those who look into the perfect law, the law of liberty. We don't tend to think of law as perfect. We seem to see it as restraining and oppressive. But he has put together two words that are very, very paradoxical to us, but not to him. The law of liberty. And the reason why they're not a problem for him is he's Jewish. And the Jews had a very positive view of the law. For them, blessed is the man whose delight is in the law of the Lord. On it that person meditates day and night. Or Psalm 19:7, the law of the Lord is perfect, it revives the soul. Or Psalm 119, which is a lengthy, the longest psalm there is, which extols the virtues and values of the law. I shall walk at liberty, for I have sought your precepts. When we get into the faith and works part of James, one of the reasons that Luther despised James and wanted it to be removed from the canon is he couldn't make it fit with Paul, that we're saved not by works but by faith. And the reason Luther had that problem, he's not reading James like a Jewish Christian who has this very positive view of the law, that the law actually liberates us. It brings freedom. God gives it so that we'd obey it and know the right way, the righteous way, the whole way, the good way. And because of that, James is able to view the law given in the gospel now and viewed through Christ as a law that frees us from the lust and deceits that so oppress us. That takes us back to the first part of chapter 1, where he says, you know what your problem is when you're tempted? We're tempted by our own deceitful desires that lure us away. Well, now we're freed from those desires through the gospel, through the word, through the law of liberty, as understood through Christ. That makes the law a beautiful thing, because we now have the power in the Spirit to obey it. Think of the Ten Commandments. The last one, thou shalt not covet. No matter what you do, it's impossible to legislate thou shalt not covet, because it has to do with an envious desire for other stuff, this deceitful desire that can overwhelm us. Well, James is now saying, through the Spirit and by the living Christ, you now have the liberty to serve. You are freed to serve. And that's something Luther did get, that the true free person is free now to serve. They're free to obey. They're at liberty through the Spirit to finally do that which the law requires. And that, of course, is what James is trying to get at. He talks about pure and undefiled religion. And what he is trying to do is to create a community that is a community of doers. Here he says in verse 26, if any think they're religious and do not bridle their tongues but deceive their hearts, their religion is worthless, but religion that's pure and undefiled. So he's talking about religion, and he's talking about it in a positive sense. He's aware that there's bad religion. That's why he's inviting us to pure and undefiled religion. He understands that religion can go sour, and many in our world, and even some Christians, view religion as always bad, and they'll say, I don't have religion, I have a relationship. The challenge of that is always, well, how do you corporately express that? How do you share that with the community? It's not just your own personal relationship. We are drawn together in a covenant community that's called to follow in the way of Christ. So how do we embody that as a community? And James knows that religion can be good or bad, and is inviting us to have a pure and undefiled religion of shared creeds and values and corporate and personal actions. And he gives three marks of a faithful community, of a community of doers, people not just looking into the mirror, but acting upon what they see. The first thing he invites us to is what he's already alluded to in verse 19. Be quick to listen, slow to speak, slow to anger. He's talked already about corrupt language and hurtful speech that can harm others. But now he says in verse 26, if you think you're religious and don't bridle or restrain your tongues, you deceive your heart and your religion is worthless. Useless. It has no value. And as always, James is building on what he's learned from Jesus. Jesus is the one who said, out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks. If you want to know what's in the heart, listen to the words that emanate from the lips. That's how you can tell the condition of the heart. If it's full of cursing, if it's full of scorning and undermining others, you know that there's hatred and anger brewing in the heart. So James invites us to bridle our tongues because he knows we're always going to wrestle with speech, we're always going to wrestle with anger, and we need to learn how to restrain that expression, for if there's no control of that, our religion, and he uses such a harsh word, it's useless. It has zero value. So he invites us, don't be deceived. Listening and doing are different things. We might look into the mirror, but are we reacting and responding and restraining our tongues? So I think James would say, no matter how consistent our church attendance, no matter how excellent our singing, no matter how well we can speak orthodoxy, if we don't bridle our tongue through hurtful words toward others or in scorn, if we don't bridle it, then our faith is at least immature, if not in question. So that's the first mark, controlled speech from calm hearts. But then he moves on to two other items. The first is sacrificial care for the weak and needy. Verse 27, religion that's pure and undefiled before God, the Father, is this, to care for orphans and widows in their distress. Now this is another thing that throughout the Torah, the Jewish law, this was of vital importance, that one cared for the strangers, that one understood that we were once strangers in Egypt as well. And this call to make sure that those who were the least fortunate in that society, that had no government program to help support them, were cared for. So that Deuteronomy 10, for example, you shall not abuse any widow or orphan, or Isaiah the prophet, defend the orphan, plead for the widow. You have this demand for charity. Why? Because God is, in verse 27, the Father. And the Father of orphans, the Father or husband to widows, so that Richard Platt says it best, better than I could ever say it. This is religion God accepts, as James says. God is Father to the fatherless. Looking after widows and orphans is not an option for the church. It is an obligation for the church. Pure and undefiled religion doesn't just focus on looking at oneself in the mirror, but after looking into the mirror and making the proper changes, it then moves outward to the world to help alleviate the suffering of those who cannot help themselves. So that pure religion for James will always include human compassion and earthly efforts to alleviate suffering. That's why I find it so affirming and so wonderful that this congregation, every Sunday when we take our offering, there's an envelope that if you put it in, it goes to our benevolence fund. And there are countless people, I can tell you, being here week in, week out, that we vet and work through and try to help with benevolence so that they, in their distress and their challenges, might have some support, that they might have some help in some way. We have a lot of money in that. Now, we've spent some of that money, but we have more than enough right now. We've had more than enough for years, and I think in some way you need to be aware that we are using that to help those in distress and support. Of course, you could point to the obvious circle of friends that helps those who are in great need, going through severe distress, but you can't get more literal. This is pure and undefiled religion than to look at the India mission and say, there, we're caring for widows, we're caring for orphans. It's not an option. It's not something we can decide to do if we have a little extra. It's an obligation, and that's where we seek to be a community of heart, a community of charity, a community that is following with the marks of doers, and not just having controlled speech, but sacrificial care for the weak and needy. But then he offers one more thing, and it's at the very end, and he just kind of throws it in at the end. To care for orphans and widows in distress, and if you look at the last line, to keep yourself unspotted or unstained by the world, which is a way of saying, as Romans 12 says, be not conformed to this world, but be ye transformed, or as the Phillips translation says, don't let the world press you into its mold. Because we live in a world that is violent and angry and full of scorn and hatred. We live in that kind of world. And James is telling us, just as Jesus tells us, just as Paul does, don't let the world press you into its mold thinking that religion ought to bear those marks of a violent and angry and scornful world. Instead, we need to be charitable. We need to speak truth in love. We need to be a people who are transformed into Christ's image. And he certainly isn't violent and angry and scornful and hateful, no matter what we do with the Gospels. So James is inviting us to three marks. He's inviting us to look into the mirror of the Word, to understand Christ as the fulfillment of Torah, who brings us and births us to salvation. That's why the verse that's repeated twice in your reading, it's kind of good that it is. You can look at either 21 that you want to. Therefore, rid yourselves of all filthiness and all abundance of malice, and welcome with meekness the implanted Word that has the power to save your souls. He doesn't only want us to hear the Word. He wants us to receive and welcome and plant it deep in our hearts. And it's only then that it begins the salvation of our souls. It changes our speech. It gives us charitable hearts. It allows us to live holy lives. So that the point of hearing is not just to nod our heads and say, that's a good idea. It's to commit to the word that we've heard. To follow in the way that it leads us. To look long into that mirror and consider, what is it that I need to change after I'm done looking at this mirror? Because if I walk away and immediately forget, it was really of no value to look in the mirror in the first place. So how long does your conviction last? I am quite aware that my sermons go everywhere from poor to great and a lot in the middle. I don't assume that when I try to open up and exegete the word that everything is always applicable to everybody. But I invite you, whenever you read the word or hear the word or pray, that you ask yourselves, how long is this conviction going to last? You know, we heard last week about anger. We heard the week before about trials. And how long does it last? Does it stew there a while? Is it long enough to make a change and for us to act upon it? What's interesting about the man in the mirror is he did everything right up to a point. Just like you and I this morning, he looked into the Word. He looked into the mirror. Just like you and I, he saw his true condition. And just like you and I this morning, he realized his need to change. And may I say, thank God that you're here. Thank God that you're listening. Thank God that there's a community of faith where we can gather around the Word and at least hold the mirror up and consider what is true, what's right, what's holy. But if that's as far as we go, James says, our religion is worthless. Because if we think listening is enough, James uses this word, we're self-deceived. To be self-deceived is to believe that hearing is enough. It makes sense. There's a big difference between reading a menu and eating a meal. And just because we've read the menu this morning doesn't at all mean that we've enjoyed a meal. There's a big difference between reading your prescription and taking your medicine. If you don't take your medicine, what good is the prescription? And James is saying, yes, look in the mirror, but make sure that look wasn't worthless. Make sure that you act upon it. Make sure that these marks become more and more marks of your life so that we can show pure and undefiled religion, that we've learned to bridle our tongues, that we've learned to care and to serve those who are weak and needy, and that we have learned that the ways of the world are not necessarily the ways that we're to conform ourselves to. In fact, there should be some areas where we're completely distinct from and in opposition to. Because the point is transformation. And James says if we do that, there will be blessing. Because he knows that a religion that's all talk and no action is useless. Even if it's talk about the Scriptures. Let us pray.